an arrow to when you're doing it in the shack, to wrap it around whatever you want to. The only other thing I worry about a little bit, and that is every piece of coax cable, LMR-400, RG-214, RG-8, RG-58, when you go to the data sheet, there is a minimum radius you should not exceed. In other words, if it tells you don't make the bend radius any less than 4 inches of radius, or 4 inches of diameter, don't exceed that. Because when you bend the cable too sharply, and then you put a lot of RF energy through it where it gets some heating, you could get some drift of the center conductor, and you could get some grease. So other than that minimum bend radius, you can do anything you want. And by the same token, don't bend it with a real sharp bend around the corner of put it around the edge of a desk, so to speak. So do observe the bend radius, but other than that, wrap it around anything you want in the shack. Over to you, Neil. KD2CMQ, K2LAW, the tech man.
Okay, Dick, one bit of clarification. The four-man choke I was talking about, I'm not going to put a conductive hole through the middle of it. It's basically electrical conduit, two-inch electrical conduit with a two-inch dowel in the middle of it to give it some strength. That's what I'm going to use the mast to put the antenna on. At least, hopefully that will work. But pretty much I'm looking at a non-conductive object going through the middle of this conductor. Over.
Yeah, very fine, Neil. When we build the poor man's balance as an RF choke, multiple turns of coax right at the dipole itself, usually the dielectric in the center of that coil is air. And now you're asking if I put wood, PVC, and other dielectric materials, what happens? And I think the answer is the inductance might actually go up a little bit. In other words, because you're creating a material with a real dielectric constant, higher than air, therefore the velocity factor goes down a little bit. In other words, you think you're using 5 feet of cable, but now electronically it's going to act like 7 feet of cable because you're wrapping it on a dielectric material. There's a slip chance that actually slightly increases the inductance. It's not going to do anything bad, and it might even do something good. So with a little bit of experimentation, I give you a 95% chance it's going to work like a charm, Neil. And when you do that, and you do test it, please come back and tell us how successful it was. Because you're in an area right now where not many of us have experimented. We haven't put specific dielectric materials in the poor man's RF choke. However, when you think about the commercial version of these balance we can buy, where you've got these ferrite, great big ferrite beads on the outside of the coax, and in some cases they're wrapped on various materials, and put inside of a PVC piece of tubing that holds it all together. From that point of view, there really is history in what you're doing. I think it's going to work. It's got to work, Neil. K2CMQ, K2LAW, the tech man.
Well, as always, thank you very much for your information. I really do appreciate it. And K2CMQ, back to net. Thank you.
At a quick break, Neil, when you said that you worry a little bit about the power output from the repeater being read by the fillings and the teeth of your children, in other words, you're close enough to the repeater that you're getting a lot of RF from it, does that mean that sometimes some of the electronics in your house gives you a little bit of grief? The amount of RF you get because you're so close to the repeater, and by the way, there's a whole lot of auxiliary transmitters at that exact location. Do any of those ever give any of the electronics in your house, your cell phone, your remote control for the TV set or whatever, do any of those pieces of electronics in your house have any RF interference from that local source? You're in one of the, well, RF-wise, you're in one of the real hot spots of the world, Neil. KD2CMQ, K2LIW.
Oh yes, you're right about that. Actually, if you look on the other side of the Grand Central Parkway, government owns some rather large antennas. However, since the advent of cable television, I haven't seen any indications of RFI affecting anything in the house
over to the mailbag. And John, you've got some time, and some of those scientists that, that write these great emails to you, what kind of breakthroughs are we working on this week, John? KC2WGB. Here we go. KC2WGB. K2I, W in segment. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Nick. Well, everyone on the net. Well, we've got a couple of baggy questions, and then one scientific information question. So, I'll let you let it drop. We'll go on to one of the baggies.
My favorite subject.
Okay, the first one about Yagis. Gentlemen is questioning. A Yagi has built a metallic dome. Are the directors, the reflectors, connected to the boom itself? Okay. And then, if it's an insulated boom, like fiberglass or wood, do they have to be connected to each other? He's interested in constructing a Yagi. And he needs that information because if he puts it on a wood boom, he doesn't think these directors and reflectors are going to work. So maybe you can give him a quick rundown on that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, these are very good common sense questions, John. First of all, the individual parasitic elements of a Yagi do not have to be electronically connected to each other. There's a lot of advantages of not being electronically connected to each other. What a Yagi really is a driven element radiating in a dipole-like manner, and a bunch of parasitic elements, a bunch of directors usually, and at least one reflector. And each of those parasitic elements is a reactant at a position in three-dimensional space. That first director, like all the other directors, second, third, and fourth, are a little bit shorter than the resonant length. Therefore, they're acting like a capacitor. They've got a capacitive reactance. Whenever you make a dipole shorter than the electrical length, it has a capacitive impedance. Make it longer than a half wave, it's got an inductive feed. So they're all the directors are shorter than the resonant length. They all are capacitive. You're literally making three-dimensional capacitors in space. You're putting them in very particular positions. Those capacitors constitute a slow wave structure. When you're in the receiving mode, that beautiful planar wave coming into the front end of your Yagi sees that first set of directors, and the portion of the wave that's closest to the boom sees those directors, those capacitors, and it propagates more slowly than the portion of the wave further out away from the boom. Therefore, that beautiful planar wave from space starts taking on a concave wave shape viewed from the driven element's point of view, because the portion of that wave closest to the boom is traveling slower. Because the wave always travels at right angles to the local planar portion of that wave, you literally... By making that wave take on that concave shape, it now is taking the portion of the wave far out away from the boom, above, below, left, and right, and focusing it on the driven element. That series of directors is a magnifying glass. You know the way you can take a magnifying glass and focus the sun onto your newspaper, get a hot spot and burn a hole in the newspaper? Well, the magnifying glass function of those directors on your Yagi is doing that. And so when each of the directors is the right length and giving the right amount of capacitance and the right position in space, you get that beautiful focusing action. If the directors, for mechanical reasons, are mounted directly to a metallic boom, and you only got two, three, or four elements altogether for your Yagi, that works like a charm. As you start going to longer and longer Yagi, 5, 6, 7, 10, 15, 20 elements, I recommend you do not drill them directly through a metallic boom, because when the elements go through the boom, they're eventually going to build up aluminum oxide. When they build up that aluminum oxide, they're going to break contact with the boom. When they break contact with the boom, let me drop. contact with the moon, they will be tuned to another frequency. So you can have your long Yagi with the elements going through the metallic boom, and a couple of years downrange, they start picking up aluminum oxide, they start breaking contact with the boom, they start tuning themselves to some other frequency, and very slowly your Yagi starts losing performance. So with, I like aluminum boom for a Yagi for good mechanical reasons, but when you do that, I strongly recommend you insulate the elements from the boom with these bushings. Take a look at the RIW-19 Yagi. You'll see that all of the directors are insulated from the boom with these metallic, with these Delrin, black Delrin bushings, which ultraviolet protected plastic. That way, aluminum oxide doesn't build up, and that builds breaking contact with the boom, and that, therefore not detuning themselves. Lots of guys avoid the problem by using a piece of PVC pipe or wood or whatever for the boom. And that works like a charm electronically, but there's a problem. The PVC pipe will sag, the wood will develop rot, and it'll suck up water on a rainy day, and so you get other kinds of changes. But let me drop on this one. If you go to this beautiful Yagi article where you can build very high performance Yagis for a couple of dollars, by going to Ken Britton's article, Whiskey Alpha 5, VictorJulianBravo.com. Go to Whiskey Alpha 5, VictorJulianBravo.com. Ken Britton's article, where he sells these green printed circuit UHF Yagi antennas. And you go to his second page, where he's got these inexpensive Yagis that are built out of coat hanger wire, literally. And he uses a strip of wood as the boom. You get very high performance Yagis with coat hanger wire, and his driven element is a J-like device. Doesn't even have a balance to it, yet it works like a charm, and he's got the patent on that one, by the way. So you can build Yagis with booms made out of insulating material, and when properly tuned, it'll work like a charm. You can build a Yagi with metallic booms and the elements going through the boom, and when the Yagis are brand new or there's a small number of elements, that works like a charm. The reason why you can put the elements through the boom, a metallic boom, and you only got three elements, is that when they break contact, there's so few of those directors, the amount of detuning is not significant. You start going to 5, 6, 8, 10 elements, Yagi, and now each one of those elements breaks contact with the aluminum boom and retunes itself to another frequency, all of a sudden you're going to get a significant change in the performance of.
You might want to mention that if you had a plastic boom and it was sagging, it really wouldn't have much of an effect on it. Nor would it have an effect if the elements were not perfectly lined up, you know, sagging. It doesn't have a great effect.
Without using laboratory equipment to measure the difference in the performance. in the process of me running my ratiometry antenna range, and you can read about that in the, I think it's the March issue, 1975 QST. You go to the QST archives and you look up K2RIW, you'll find out something about the ratiometry antenna range, which I set up in my backyard, where I could resolve a 20th of a dB of gain change. Very accurate antenna range, which, by the way, is now being used by the Romare Development Center in Utica, New York. Anyhow, what I'm getting at is that as you start tilting individual elements so they're not in the same plane, you tilt them left and right, and you sag the whole boom up and down, you think the Aggie is going to fail. You'd be amazed how far you can go with that before you can even measure any change in the performance. Because the basic philosophy of the Aggie, the physics of how it works, is each one of those parasitic elements is a capacitor, a flow wave structure, a reactant at a particular position in space. And the fact that you displace that position a little bit vertically because of the sag of the boom, until you bend that boom into a U shape, you'll be amazed how much you can get away with. A Yagi is a weird mixture of things that are sensitive and insensitive. When it comes to a long, high-performance Yagi, on four, say, for instance, 432, you want all those elements to be the right diameter, very close to the right diameter, and the right length to the nearest 16th of an inch. You start making a cumulative error, you'll end up with an antenna tuned to some other frequency. So they're very sensitive to diameter and length. They're very insensitive to individual juggles of position of the Yagi parasitic element along the boom. They're very insensitive to the tilt left and right of those individual elements. You can tilt them plus or minus 30 degrees. And you repeat, time out. You can tilt them plus or minus 30 degrees and almost nothing will happen. The individual elements, you can move them on a 432 Yagi plus or minus a half an inch, maybe three quarters of an inch forward and reverse, as long as it's not an accumulative error, and it'll work like a charm. And the whole darn boom can sag down probably at a 20 or 30 degree angle at the tip versus the driven element area, and you still get almost full performance with the exact same pattern in three-dimensional space. As I said, a Yagi is a weird mixture of things that are very sensitive and things that are very insensitive. So you've actually done some real tuning of a Yagi on a very accurate antenna range in your own backyard. You wouldn't believe it. Maybe some of this helps though. For the guys who want to build their own inexpensive Yagi, I do recommend you look at that Whiskey Alpha 5 Victor Juliet Bravo .com. Go to that particular website. I think it's com.org.com. And look at his very inexpensive, what I call it now, coat hanger wire, yes. AC2, WGB, H-R-I-W in a second. Go ahead, John. AC2 WGB. Very good, then. So then we can recommend to him that the tags and elements, maybe the directors, or the reflectors, do not have to be connected to each other. No way. They can all be freestanding. All right. That should make it easier for him. But, yeah, he's really concerned about that. All right, let me drop my voice for a second.
CP's Adler, comment.
Okay, Hal, go ahead with your comment.
Turn the...
I'm sorry to say, Hal, you were pure dropout. We heard 1/2 second at a time, 3 times in a row, all we heard. So until you got a little bit more power and you're in a better position, I don't know if we're going to be able to get your message. I'll pass it to you one more time, Hal, give it a try. And other than that, we'll wait a little bit later and get your message. K6, doing permanent, Delta Papa Zulu, K2RIW, go ahead, Al.
K2RIW, K6, DPC, the same. And a little Japanese scientist in Japan, we have to give the credit to, but Yagi, if you didn't mention that.
Yeah, this is Tsubu Yagi, 1928. Along with his student, Mr. Uda. Yagi and Uda invented that antenna in 1928, first published the American version of that article. And there was a guy called K2RIW who had the chutzpah in roughly 2003 or 2004.
2004 to reinvent the Yagi and patent it again. You take a look at my name and the list of patents with the U.S. Patent Office, you'll find out I repatented a Yagi antenna in roughly 2003, but the original patent was 1928 by the Yagi and Mr. Uda. The real antenna enthusiasts will call the Yagi Uda Array. A few of the real inside people will call it a Uda Yagi Array because they sense that Uda, the student, did most of the work. Yagi got most of the credit because he was the professor who Uda was working for. There's a lot of history behind that antenna. But when it comes to gain per pound, gain per square foot of wind area, gain per dollar of materials involved in whatever, there is no antenna in the world that gives you more bang for the dollar than a Yagi. At the VHF frequencies where it works very well, on 30 to 1,000 megacycles, we'll say, properly, no, here we go. If you've got the resources, you can build a Yagi on 160 meters, and a few people have done it, out of wire and other things like that. So on HF to UHF frequencies, there are very few antennas that will give you more bang for the dollar than a Yagi. And so that antenna that I built with 16 Yagi on 432, which you'll see on my QSL card, if you go to the right website, you'll see what it looks like. This antenna array with 3,500 cubic feet, and I'm standing in the middle of it on the top of 100 foot of power. Now that's a Yagi with 16 Yagi, 19 elements each, 314 elements all together. 29 meters gain over isotropic, and I heard my own moon bounce that goes on 432 with that antenna. And I also, for 4.5 years, held a QSO on single sideband 432 with K4CAW, Greensboro, North Carolina, 408 airline miles from me, 200 miles inland in North Carolina. Every Tuesday night for 4.5 years, he and I would talk on 432 sideband, using that antenna. And guys that were in this area who were not using that kind of an antenna were not hearing him. They thought that it was a farce. They thought that we were really on the telephone and not doing that conversation. And in those days, that would have been one hell of a phone call. Half hour every night, Tuesday night, for 4.5 solid years. Eventually, some of the guys in the middle started saying, hey, I'm hearing these guys on both ends. These guys are really doing it. So, arguably, that, at that time, that was one of the highest gain Yagi arrays that existed. I built that thing way back in, what was it, 1980, roughly, is when I was doing that work. Okay, so Yagi antennas, lots and lots of performance, if you know how to tune them. And nowadays, there are fancy computer programs that will help you optimize those. And when you optimize a Yagi, do not optimize it to make zero amplitude side loads. When you make the Yagi have the highest possible gain, let me drop. You're synthesizing a uniform distribution, circular aperture of effective capture area. Whenever you've got a perfectly uniform circular area antenna of multiple wavelengths of diameter, the laws of physics dictate that the first side lobe will be 17.5 dB down. The second side lobe will be 21 dB down. Third side lobe will be 24 dB down. When you tune a Yagi and you maximize the gain, you'll find out it's got those side lobe amplitudes. And you can, if you want to, disturb the limit daylight to the tuning of the Yagi, and you can make those side lobes weaker than that. If you do that, you end up with less gain and a broader beamwidth. Opposite of common sense. You think that all of those side lobes represent wasted energy. Absolutely not. The highest gain aperture antenna on planet Earth is a parabolic dish reflector that has lots and lots of wavelengths. The 200 inch diameter, 16 and 3 quarter foot diameter Palomar parabolic dish antenna in Palomar, California. Arguably the highest gain antenna in the world at that time, 138 dB of gain. That antenna has side lobes that are 17.5 dB down, 21 dB down, and so on, if you know what I mean. The laws of physics dictate that. So don't fall into the trap of thinking you're going to tune your Yagi to maximize the gain by knocking the side lobes down to minus infinity. You cannot do that
can't have zero side lobes and maximum gain. Opposite with common sense. I know we're off to one side, but it's one of the crazy pieces of information about Yagi antennas. Over to you, John. Go ahead with your next Yagi question. One of my favorite areas. KC2WGV, KQLIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, then. Very good. Yeah, a lot of information you didn't get. All right, Michelle again has a question. Do you understand Yagi versus the isotropic radiation? Do you understand that when you have a forward projection angle of 60 degrees, 70 degrees, when you transmit, you're concentrating most of your energy to go out in that direction? And the receiver that's hearing you will hear maybe 60 degrees. All right, you understand that. And you touched basically on this answer to the previous question, but maybe you could elaborate on it. His question is, he understands the transmission gain, but he doesn't understand the reception gain. Where does that come from? How does that increase the receptive gain? Back to the case of the
John, good question. The guy is basically a scientist. One of the universal laws of the antenna science, the bedrock of the antenna science, is that every passive antenna means that it doesn't contain active amplifiers, doesn't contain gyrotropic devices, doesn't contain circulators. It's a real passive antenna made out of aluminum and plastic transmission lines. So every passive antenna obeys the law of reciprocity. That means you get a real good antenna range. Might be an anechoic chamber, it might be an outer space or whatever. You get a real good measurement laboratory for the antenna. Whatever you measure as a parameter on transmission, horizontal beamless, vertical beamless, polarization, side lobe levels, notches between the side lobe, front to back ratio, front to side ratio, all of the parameters you measure on the antenna on transmission, it'll have the exact same performance on reception on every one of those parameters. That is the law of reciprocity. All real passive antennas obey that law. So once you realize that when you're transmitting with that Yagi, and as long as the Yagi is long enough and properly tuned, and a good Yagi could easily have a 25 degree beamwidth, if you could see that beam, if you could see the radiation pattern out of that antenna, if your eyes operated at 432, for instance, what would you see? The main lobe would look like a great big fat cucumber in space, where that cucumber would have, in the case of a 19 element Yagi, would have something like a 25 degree horizontal beamwidth and something like a 27 degree vertical beamwidth. The first side lobe, that when you look at a planar pattern of the antenna, a simple sweep across the azimuth or the elevator, you'd be in China. When you look at the simple pattern of the antenna as a horizontal and vertical sweep, you're taking a slice through that three-dimensional antenna pattern. You'll think you'll see a first side lobe, 10.5 dB down, 17.5 dB down, and a second side lobe, 21 dB down. Those side lobes are not lobes, they are rings in space. That main lobe is a great big cucumber. At the base of that cucumber is a ring of energy, a little bit off to one side, or a greater number of degrees off to one side, and considerably weaker in magnitude in the main lobe than the foresight of that cucumber. And that first side lobe is a ring in space. The second side lobe is another ring in space. All real Yagi antennas have that three-dimensional antenna pattern on transmission and on reception. Remember now I told you that Yagi of mine with 19 elements, where each of the elements are a little bit less than 1 foot long, that antenna has an effective capture area of 5.5 foot diameter circle. That planar wave coming in from space when you're receiving, that planar wave hits the front end of that Yagi, starts bending in a very complicated manner, starts becoming, that planar wave starts off as a flat surface, it starts becoming concave from the point of view of the driven element, and eventually it focuses that energy from 5.5 diameter of space down to the driven element, like a magnifying glass. That's what's happening on reception. Let me drive There are people in the past who tried to explain Yagi reception theory as a cascade of filter. Each one of those parasitic elements, they thought it was like an LC network of a filter. And each one of those filter elements gathers a certain amount of energy and passes it to the next element. Good sounding theory, dead wrong. That's not what's happening. Each one of those parasitic elements is a reactant in three-dimensional space in a particular position, because they're all a little bit shorter than a resonant length. They are capacitive. A capacitive element in three-dimensional space is the slow wave structure. You can make capacitive in three-dimensional space by putting parasitic elements in there that are less than a half wavelength long, or you can put a chunk of foam out there that has a certain dielectric constant to it, which is also a slow wave structure. There's all kinds of ways you can make the slow wave structure. There's something called the Koch antenna, K-O-C-H, I think is the way the man's name is spelled, where he takes a great big chunk of low-density foam, and he buries a bunch of washers in it, and he makes the density of the washers, the spacing between the washers, very small in the center of this great big sheet of foam, and much further apart at the edge. He is synthesizing three-dimensional space, a magnifying glass. Is what a magnifying glass really is another kind of slow wave structure. The glass in your magnifying glass has a thicker amount of glass in the center than out at the perimeter. That planar wave coming from the sun hits your magnifying glass. The center of the magnifying glass has got more glass, more thickness. It can slow down more than the wave out at the perimeter. It makes that incoming planar wave take on a concave shape, and that is the focus of spectrism. And the energy gets focused down to a point, and it burns a hole in your newspaper when you're using the magnifying glass on the sun in that manner. The way that magnifying glass works and the way a long Yagi works is almost a one-to-one relationship. The Yagi is a skeleton structure, a synthesized structure that is acting like that magnifying glass. Yes, it's much longer in the Z dimension than a magnifying glass, and that's one of the, that's part of the magic of how a Yagi can do that. You could, if you want to, take a piece of thick foam and cut it into the shape of a magnifying glass, and you would get the approximately the exact same amount of gain as a Yagi. However, a great big chunk of foam in three-dimensional space would have a whole lot of wind load. And that Yagi element, that Yagi of that boom and a couple of directors out there and pieces of wire or aluminum tubing, there's a hell of a lot less wind load, a hell of a lot less weight, and it does the exact same thing. It's a skeleton synthesized structure. It's a synthesized slow wave structure in three-dimensional space with a particular velocity profile. In other words, the way you tune the Yagi, each of the individual elements when you make an optimal design has a particular tuning length in a particular position. They're not all the same length. You start off with somebody's real good Yagi design with 16 elements, as I did, by starting off with Gunter Hock, DL6WU, his 16 element Yagi, and I decided to add some more elements to it. I had to retune all of the elements to make that magnifying glass have a longer focal length in order to bring the energy all back to a focus on the driven element. You would think, by common sense, you make the Yagi longer by just adding more Yagi elements out in front, more parasitic elements. Absolutely not. If you want optimum performance, yes, you're going to make it longer, yes, you're going to add more elements, but you're going to retune all of them to have a different velocity profile, a different focal length, in order for the longer Yagi with the higher gain to still focus all of that energy onto the driven element. What mode you use in your receiver and the reverse mode you receive it. CW mode or FM mode, and how strong was the signal. So, as you can tell, a Yagi on reception and on transmission has the exact same effective area. I could, if I wanted to, in theory, start off with a 6-foot diameter parabolic dish reflector and come up with very similar gain as a simple 90-foot on a Yagi. A 6-foot diameter dish would have a hell of a lot more weight to it. And I'd have to be careful as to what I use for the feed going for it. But it's hard to believe, but a well-tuned Yagi has got a lot more area on reception and on transmission than what your eye sees. But by the law of reciprocity, it's got to be there. Again, it's part of the magic of resonance. It's part of the magic of the parasitic elements being a little bit off resonance, where they're acting like capacitors. And as I said, it's a synthesized, distributed slow wave structure with a particular velocity profile. Velocity profile means that how much the wave can slow down at the beginning of the Yagi, way down in front, in the middle of the Yagi, and at the end of the Yagi, close to the driven element. How much it slowed down is a function of how far off resonance are each one of those parasitic elements and what is their spacing. And when you get that slow wave structure to have just the right velocity profile, velocity at that particular position along the boom, you end up with the maximum focusing action and the maximum gain, which really means maximum effective area on reception and or transmission. I know that the first time you hear these words, it doesn't all make sense. But by way of the amateur radio dot TV, you can play it back a few times, go to the right.
Repeater, timeout,
by way of playing a few times on that website and going to the right book, eventually it will make sense. Whenever you hear a brand new piece of information for the first time, it doesn't always make sense. And makes you feel uncomfortable. The normal learning process is uncomfortable at first. As they tell you in every good freshman orientation class, in every good college, when you're feeling frustrated, you're learning. It's the way it has to be. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Anybody in
I did hear K6TPC over that noise, and John, you were having a little bit of trouble getting over. Howard, you wanted to say something?
Hey, just on my left, the head mention. I didn't hear the whole test match, but did you go in also to the method of matching the driven element of a Yagi? As far as a T-match, gamma match, solar dot pole match, etc.?
Agree with that one, pal. John, go on with your next one. KC2WJV, meet you RIW in the deck man.
KC2WJV. Okay, we've got a speed of light question. And are you copying the LZ?
Beautifully, and please proceed. And even if I don't, I can copy you in the input, so don't worry.
They're traveling exactly the same course. They're traveling at 97% speed of light. They're a light year apart. Spacecraft A is in the lead. B is behind. If spacecraft A transmits a signal, will spacecraft B receive it in 6 months instead of a year? Back to you, Dick.
WS to us.
Yeah, the question is, you've got these two spacecraft both traveling at 95% of the speed of light, and one is one light year ahead of the other one. And so now, when the first spacecraft starts sending a message toward the second spacecraft, will the message get there one year, one half year? How long will it take for the message to get from the first spacecraft to the second spacecraft when they're both traveling at 97% of the speed of light and they're one light year apart? I don't know. Maybe you do, Paul. WS2S, K2LIW, the check net.
Yeah, it's just relative, as far as I know, it's just relative to the two spacecraft. So if they're within one light year apart and they stay that way, spacecraft B will receive the signal 1 year later. And the same thing, if he transmits backwards to the other spacecraft, if they're still a year later, if they're still 1 year apart, it'll still take a year going the other way. So it's relative to them. You know, it's no different than us flying through the universe, talking to something, you know, another person on another planet moving the same, you know, the speed of light away from us. It would take that same time to get there. You know, if a year from now, we're that same distance. That's what I think.
I think that would mean the concentric ring of emanation would have to travel with the spacecraft. I don't think that's going to do that.
I see the possibility, John, where Paul might be right. What Paul is saying, if I reword it, is that even though the two spacecraft are both moving at 97% of the speed of light, the radio wave does not know that. The radio wave doesn't know it's moving through the emptiness of space at some crazy speed on its transmitter, moving that fast. But radio wave spreads out from the first spacecraft in a spherical manner for the second spacecraft. It's one light year away. It's going to take a year to get there, is what Paul's saying. I think he's right. I think the radio wave doesn't know the difference. Now, if the spacecraft moving at 97% of the speed of light wants to talk to a guy on a planet that isn't moving, and now there's that huge difference in velocity between them, that's a very different case. But as far as these two spacecraft are concerned, the radio wave doesn't know that they're moving fast. It only knows where it left from and where it's going to, and it's spreading out in a spherical manner. And so the next question is that if it's spreading out in a spherical manner from the first spacecraft, does that mean the leading edge of the wave going forward is now moving at 1.97 times the speed of light? Let me ask Paul that one. The portion of the wave, assuming now it's an isotropic antenna on the transmitting spacecraft, Paul, the portion of the wave that's going forward, is it moving at 1.97 the speed of light? WS2S, K2LIW, the check net.
Moving at the speed of light in the vacuum. That's it. It's underwater with the speed of light. You know, but it's being a little slower, but with tons of water. Vacuum is a vacuum. So your frequency is going to be different. If that's what you're asking, if you're standing on a planet and he's coming towards you at the speed of light, your Doppler effect will definitely change. You'll be transmitting on one frequency, and you'll be hearing it at another.
Look at the problem here now, Paul. Assume that the trailing spacecraft, one light year behind the forward, they're both moving at 0.97 speed of light. The trailing spacecraft wants to send a signal to the forward spacecraft, and they're one light year apart. How long does the signal take to get from the backward spacecraft to the forward spacecraft? If the answer is 1 year, then with reference to a fixed point of measurement, that wave from the backward spacecraft, the forward portion of the wave, is moving at 1.97 the speed of light. If the wave left the rear spacecraft at exactly the speed of light, and there's only 3/10 of a percent of velocity difference between the two, at sounds at first like it's going to take a long time for that wave from the backward spacecraft to get to the forward spacecraft. It's a little bit of a problem here, Paul. WS2X, K2LIW.
And Dick, this came from a 14-year-old.
Look out for those 14-year-olders. When they ask why four times in a row, you're in trouble. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes,
confusing the question. The two spacecraft, when they talk to each other, it's still going to be 1 year. As long as they stay the same speed to each other, it's going to take 1 year to go from A to B and from B to A. And now when you're talking about a planet that's watching them go by, I know you got a Doppler effect when they're coming towards you and away from you. It's definitely a time problem. Radio waves going to go at the speed of light, but there's going to be time dilation involved. You know, the clock on a spacecraft is going to be going at one speed, and on the planet it's going to be going at another. As far as the radio wave goes, I think you're going to have a Doppler change, but it's still going to. Radio wave is not going to change. It's not going to change. It's not going to go any faster or slower.
KD2CXK with a comment.
CXK, we're going to get to you in a second, but I've got to repeat this question to Paul. Paul, we've got two spacecraft, one directly behind the other, both traveling in a straight line. The one behind is one light year behind the one in front. Both spacecraft are moving at 0.97 the speed of light. The guy in the back starts transmitting. He's one light year behind the guy in the front. And you say the radio signal is going to go from the backward guy to the forward guy in 1 year. Okay? To travel one light year of distance when the back guy is moving 0.97 the speed of light, then with reference to a fixed reference trip position, to be telling me that radio wave from the back guy is going toward the forward guy at 1.97 speed of light. That's the only way it can get there in one light year. So how does it get there in 1 year when both of them are traveling at 0.97 the speed of light? What is the speed of that radio wave, the forward edge of that radio wave going toward the forward spacecraft? How fast is it moving with reference to a fixed reference system? WS2N, K2RIW.
Zulu Tango, Zulu Info.
Okay, I'm going to go. We'll let it info go in a second. I'll go one more time. Time dilation, I think that it's going to be one year on the spacecraft. He's going to see it in 1 year that the guy's going to get the reception and on Earth, or the receiving guy might take a couple of years for him. But as far as the spacecraft is concerned, that's radio wave. It's not going to go any faster or slower. It's not going to take 2 years as far as the radio wave is concerned when it's flying through space. The radio wave thinks it's going to be 1 year. The guy on Earth will probably be 2 years. I heard somebody with info that maybe they got a better answer back here.
Yeah, we got some smarter guys out there that have been studying the speed of light. We got both Craig and Scott in that order. Craig, straighten us out of this one. We're a little bit baffled. It's 82CXK. K2LIW is taking that. Go ahead, Craig.
K2CXK, good evening, everybody. Okay, I'm sure I'm going to get my clock clean for this one, assuming the clock is, of course, spinning at the right speed.